This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. Back in August 2018, photojournalist, activist and educator Shahidul Alam was imprisoned by the Bangladeshi government after criticising their handling of road safety demonstrations and commenting on the crisis in an interview with Al Jazeera. He was finally granted bail in the face of overwhelming international support for his safe release. But despite everything that happened to him, including his arrest and torture, Shahidul continues to speak truth to power and to speak out against injustice. One of Time Magazine's Persons of the Year in 2018, he joins me now to share his story and to explain why he is not holding back his criticism of the Bangladeshi government. Welcome, Shahidul. How are you today?
Good to be here.
Thank you so much for joining me. So, I mean, if we can just get to know you a little bit better. I mean, you are the founder of the Drik Picture Library, the Patshala South Asian Media Institute, the Chobi Mela International Photography Festival, you know. But how did you become interested in photography in the first place?
It started while I was at university. I was doing a PhD in organic chemistry at London University. I got very involved with the Socialist Workers' Party. And while we were engaged in the protests and the rallies, race rights, gay rights, issues of class, all that sort of thing, including, I mean, that was the time when we were rallying for Poland, Solidarność movement and everything else. I began to see how powerfully they used photographs in their campaigns, in their resistance. And I've always been interested in social justice. I was going to go back home. And I thought, does Bangladesh need yet another research chemist? and I thought, well, this tool that I've discovered seems to be the tool to use. It's such a powerful device. I didn't know at that time whether I could make a living as a photographer. So I tried it out. In London, I started working for a small studio, taking pictures of children and things like that. But that didn't do much for my photography, but it gave me the people skills. Mm-hmm. And also it gave me a sort of confidence. I felt, okay, I could actually make a living out of this perhaps. I went back home, but then I'd left immediately after the War of Liberation, left an independent country to come over to study. When I went back, it was under military occupation. So it was as an activist trying to bring down this military general that I began the sort of photography that I do today.
Okay. And I mean, you know, journalists have written that, you know, you use your camera as an instrument of conscience and beauty, right? And why was activism something that mattered to you even back then?
I think I've grown up that way. I mean, Bangladesh's history, Bangladesh's turbulent history, has all of those hallmarks of struggle. And the reason we have the nation is because we had to fight even for the right to speak our own language. Mm. I've been through riots. I've been through genocide. I've seen injustice close up. And I think you cannot go through that without it affecting you in some way. So the idea that we would have a land of our own was so important to me. To then find that this land has been robbed again, I think I didn't have a choice.
Mm-hmm. And was it very jarring for you coming back from the UK to come back to this situation? You know, was it quite traumatic for you in that sense?
The trauma wasn't so much coming back to Bangladesh in terms of what one might normally assume in terms of the difference between Britain and Bangladesh. I mean, that I knew. I mean, I live and work less than 3 miles from where I was born. This is my land. Mm-hmm. So that didn't affect me. But certainly the fact that we had such dreams, such hopes for an egalitarian country, that we would live, that the average Bangladeshi would live a very different life. And the fact that the rulers had a very different take on what this nation, and was taking this nation into very different directions, that was what jarred. But there was resilience. There certainly were very, very good people on the ground fighting the good fight. And being part of that meant a lot to me.
And, you know, taking those photographs that you did, you know, you snap street protesters from afar as they swarm the streets of Dhaka, and up close, you know, you studied the tension in their faces, the muscles in their clenched arms. You know, why did you choose to focus on these sort of aspects of what was happening?
That was why I got into the medium. I mean, I think it was that struggle for equality, that injustice that I saw. I mean, the raison d'etre for me being what I am is about social justice. Mm-hmm. So those were merely the manifestations. I saw what was happening around me and I did what I could. The fact that I built institutions was something I hadn't planned. And that I did largely because I recognized the absence of them. And I also, having been in Britain, having worked with agencies outside, I recognized what was needed. And the fact that an individual photographer, journalist, couldn't really make a dent into a very monolithic media establishment that had an agenda of its own and was very powerful. So I recognize that if we were to combat that storytelling, then we need to create a platform for our own storytellers.
Because I think I've, you know, read in previous interviews that you've given, you felt that, you know, the power of storytelling, it should be wrested away from Western professionals, you know, and they sort of focused on stereotype tales of Bangladesh, you know, of suffering and such, right? And but you, of course, wanted to focus on the resilience instead.
Well, precisely. I mean, I'm not that I'm trying to paint a rosy picture of what isn't there. Certainly the reality does exist and there is hardship. But I think the real story is the tenacity of the people, their resistance, their ability to overcome, and the fact that they rally around one another in the way they do. Mm. I mean, in a country like Bangladesh, people talk about development, about what NGOs do, what developmental organizations do. We forget that the average Bangladeshi, the poor of Bangladesh, plays such an important role in supporting one another.
Mm-hmm. And tell me about your work to set up Bangladesh's first photo archive, so the Drip Picture Library in Dhaka. I understand that also doubles as a multimedia activist organization.
Yeah, I mean, the thing really was, at that time, I was very conscious of the fact that Bangladesh was represented largely by white Western photographers, and they presented a stereotype about Bangladesh, which I was not comfortable with. Mm-hmm. I thought, okay, if once I was aware that it was the person who controlled the narrative that determined the story, mm-hmm. I thought, okay, we need our own storytellers, and our storytellers need a platform.
That's right.
So that was how the RIG was set up. But then as we set it up, we also recognized that the mechanisms for getting our stories out needed to be in place. So we even did things like setting up the first email network of Bangladesh, getting images out, training people, developing the infrastructure, darkroom studios, skill development, all of that. And at a later stage, we felt, well, if you've got to fight a war, you need soldiers. So that's when we set up the school.
Okay, and so that's the South Asian Media Academy?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and you covered all sorts of news events, am I correct? Natural disasters, government upheavals, even the deaths of the garment factory workers, that very famous case in Rana, if I'm not mistaken. Human rights abuses.
Yes, but, you know, I think we also celebrate the successes that we have.
That's right.
So, and when I talk about these, I think if one looks at it merely from the lens of repression and oppression, one forgets that there is another side to the story. The struggle for democracy is a people's movement. And the fact that facing all these odds, these are people who will continue to fight and resist, and that our love for freedom is as great as it is, I think is an important message.
I'm speaking today to Shahidul Alam. He's a photojournalist, he's an activist, an essayist and an educator. And we're discussing the role of the political artist and, you know, the importance of documenting injustices and inequalities, but also of, you know, documenting the resilience of the people in Bangladesh. Shahidul has just released a book called The Tide Will Turn, and we're going to find out more about that after this quick break. You are listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. This is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture. I'm Juliet Jacobs, and in the studio with me today is Shahidul Alam. He's a renowned photojournalist. He's an activist. He's an essayist and an educator. He was one of Time Magazine's Persons of the Year in 2018. And Shahidul has just released a book called The Tide Will Turn, and we're going to find out a bit more about that after this. But, you know, in August 2018, you were arrested and you were thrown into jail. You were accused of trying to bring down the government and for inciting violence. Can you tell me about that?
It started on the 29th of July. There was there were two young students, Rajib and Mim, waiting outside their school for a bus. The bus did arrive, but in fact it mowed them down. They died instantly, and 11 other students were injured. Obviously led to huge protests. But the protests were not simply about road safety. I think it was a question of people having their backs against the wall. There was so much injustice for so long, and the people felt that their voices were not being heard. Mm-hmm. And the corruption, a whole range of things which were very, very wrong as far as the people were concerned, is what enraged them. The protests spread very widely, very quickly. And the fact that the government, at least the minister, was jeering about these deaths as opposed to being sympathetic to it, inflamed it further. But instead of responding to the very valid concerns that these students had, the government turned the hoodlums on these unarmed kids. So people with machetes began attacking these kids, supported by the police. I was documenting it, live streaming, reporting as well as I could. On the 4th of August, I got attacked. My equipment smashed up. I got beaten up. I continued working. On the 5th, again, I was live streaming, and I gave that interview to Al Jazeera. But then I went back home, and I was alone in the flat uploading the images for that day when the doorbell rang. And when I answered, there were these people who stormed into the flat to abduct me. I mean, I live and work in Bangladesh, so I know what happens. And at that time, my priority was to stay alive. And I knew if I went away quietly, that might be the end of it. So I resisted as much as I could in whatever way I could and delayed the process sufficiently for people to know what was happening. I was handcuffed, blindfolded, taken away, tortured that night. But the following day, I knew that others knew what had happened. Mm-hmm. And while the government then, the police that is, offered me a deal saying that should I stay quiet, everything would be forgotten, no charges made, and I'd be sent back home. Obviously, that was not a conditions I was prepared to accept. So that got them very angry. I then went to court, where I also mentioned that I'd been tortured. Then I went into remand, which is in Bangladesh a euphemism for state-sanctioned torture. I was there for a week. Then I was sent to jail. But while that was happening, really, the entire world rose up in protest, yeah. Particularly in Bangladesh, where the protests were far more dangerous to do. But here in Malaysia, but across the globe, the protests were of such a huge scale that they just couldn't contain it. They did refuse my bail 5 times, but on the 6th, they finally let me go. I'm still, the case still hangs over me, mm-hmm. and I still potentially face 14 years in prison.
Must be quite traumatic to have that hanging over your head. And I suppose that's the effect that they're looking for, isn't it?
Precisely. I mean, I think that is the strategy. But on the other hand, I've had so much support from people across the world, from people within Bangladesh and from my fellow prisoners, mm-hmm. that I feel very empowered by it. And to be fair, I think, you know, certainly while I was in jail, I faced difficulties, but the people around me were the ones who suffered the most. And I think what they did is quite phenomenal. That's the story that's not told, the mm-hmm. people who provide the support around you. And because that was there, I'm able to continue to resist.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, how were you supported? You know, I mean, who are those people who, you know, stood by you, who helped you through that very, very traumatic time?
My partner, immediately, my very close comrades, the students and alumni of the school, my colleagues at the agency, but really people across the globe. I mean, 12 Nobel laureates, Arundhati Roy, Chomsky, Naomi Klein, and other people. Some I know, but many I don't. Complete strangers, people, and I'm still discovering this, you know, people in the streets of Lagos and Dali and wherever else, and Lima, there were protests across the globe.
Confess, that's the first time I heard about you as well.
There you are. And really, I think that is it's something to reflect upon, the fact that if you've played your cards isn't the right term. If you've done what you're meant to be doing as a citizen, as a journalist, people will respond. And the fact that there are people out there who feel I give them voice gives meaning to my life.
Mm-hmm. I think you've mentioned, you know, that, you know, people in Bangladesh itself came up to you, you know, hugged you and said thank you for being...
Well, absolutely. You know, yeah. And I remember a particular situation. I mean, I've come out of the office, there's a woman outside with a baby in her arms, and she comes up to me saying, can you bless my child? I want him to grow up to be as brave as you.
Oh, wow.
It's a very humbling situation.
And something else I wanted to ask you about was, you know, your fellow inmates, you know, you did. I read you said it was almost like a networking experience, a very unusual one.
Yeah, yeah.
Tell me about, you know, who were some of your fellow inmates?
Well, firstly, they decided they were going to look after me and nothing was going to happen to me. And they made sure nothing happened to me. They knew what I liked in terms of my food preferences. They sneaked in, stole away my mosquito net, repaired it, washed it, gave it back. And really... they were my guardian angels, and they made sure that nothing would happen to me. But for me, one thing which was very special, I was in the prison hospital, and when I'd recovered enough and I came out, well, before that, in fact, they got in touch with me and said, we want one of your photographs. And it was a photograph, quite a well-known photograph of a red sailboat, which has been published in National Geographic and other places. So when I came out, I saw they painted a 12-foot mural of that image inside jail as an homage to me. That was very, very moving.
That's amazing. And I understand they even made you a radio, or got you a radio.
Yes,
so
yes,
that
yeah,
you could listen
you know,
to
here's
news.
A journalist. He has to have news. And they built a radio with very basic things, but it still works and I still have it. In fact, it's on show at the Rubin Museum in New York right now, where that's I'm having my retrospective. So it was pretty special.
You know, you had a lot of friends with, you were friends with your inmates, of course, you know, and you said, you know, they were like your guardian angels. But how did you actually spend your time there? You know, how did you pass the time while you were in prison?
Not that I'd recommend jail, but for me, it was actually very productive, I felt. I mean, I saw an aspect of my country I would not have done otherwise. I met a lot of people, many of them political prisoners, who were very passionate about what they did. Some there because they might have shared or liked me on Facebook, things of that sort. But of course, I longed for things I didn't have outside. And one of them were these sparrows I used to feed. So I removed the mosquito net on my cell window so I could, and I built a little perch, which my fellow inmates helped me build, where my sparrows would come and sit. And over a period of time, I got to know them quite well. You know, I learned their personalities and things like that. But I also did other things. I mean, people who came to visit me brought me things, gave me gifts, and I had nothing to give back. So I would collect flowers early in the morning so I could give them back. So there was that happening. And one of the things that is part of the Rubin show is, of course, while I was there, I didn't have the camera. But we decided we need to represent this in some way. My niece, Sophia Karim, is an architect and an artist. So she made these beautiful 3D printed models of me feeding my sparrow, collecting the flowers in my cell. And that is part of the show at the Rubin Museum.
That's amazing. So you spent about 100 days or so in the Dhaka Central Jail, am I correct? And I was reading that, you know, in the granting of bail, they mentioned your status as an international figure. And I guess, you know, your position and standing, you know, worked in your favour as such. But one thing that the judge said, which really troubled me, he said that you were lucky you had not been disappeared.
Yes, I think he was, that was a candid moment that he had. And I'm surprised he said it in public, but he did. And it is true, and that is what others also felt. Certainly on that first night, had I not been able to delate sufficiently, mm-hmm. that might have been the end of the story. And there are so many that it has happened to. We have a wall in our flat where we put up, we've got pictures of friends of ours who've died or been disappeared. And every so often, another picture goes up on that wall. So it's sadly very, very true.
Yeah, and you've said, you know, it's very dangerous being a journalist in Bangladesh. So, you know, are things like that, you know, physical attacks, harassment, is that commonplace for journalists and online activists?
Well, to be fair, it's not the only government that's done it. I mean, I got back in 1984 when this military general was in power. That's when I had a loaded gun held to my head. This is one of 8 knife wounds I got in the streets when I was stabbed by the next government. This government puts me in jail. So they're pretty fair in that sense. You know, they all
when you
level
put it in,
moderate.
Take it in perspective. Put it in perspective like that. Stabbed 8 times. I read about that. That was.
Yeah. But so there is that danger. Mm-hmm. But there are very, very good people working on the ground despite that, taking horrendous risks. And many of them are not people you know about. They're not people who have a high profile. They're not people who are in the media. There are people dying, disappearing every day, and that is the story. It is also a story that there are people resisting the way they are.
Mm-hmm. And I think for a lot of Malaysians, perhaps, you know, we don't quite understand what the situation is actually like in Bangladesh. You know, we don't understand why there is so much repression and fear there. Maybe you can help us understand what the situation there is like.
Firstly, the major institutions have all been decimated. So the state institutions, which would normally be in the favour of the common person, so, you know, protect them, the judiciary, the police, the bureaucracy, have all become part of the ruling party machinery. Mm-hmm. Sadly for me, what is worse is the fact that media itself has abdicated. State media has always been propaganda in my country, as it is in most countries. But independent media, one would have thought, would have given a different point of view. But today, independent media is also, to a large extent, becoming a spokesperson for the government. And that makes it very, very difficult for the average person. Mm-hmm. Who do you turn to? Who speaks up for you? So it is those independent voices who try and find some sort of avenue for free expression that become the champions of the average person, but also the people that the spotlight is on and the people who are threatened.
Mm-hmm. It must be difficult, though, of course, you know, if there is state-sponsored sort of violence against those who speak up, you know, it must be very hard for people to be that courageous, which is, I suppose, why people really rally around you and the things that you do.
It is hard, but I think one also needs to see the broader picture in the sense that one of the reasons it happens and the government gets away with it is because international community has really not played the role it should. I mean, I don't believe there is such a thing as morality in international politics, but this is a situation where, provided the government delivers on the Western agenda, the West is quite happy to turn a blind eye to human rights abuses within the country, mm-hmm. as long as their needs are met and their business community is served. They might carry on with the rhetoric of democracy and freedom, but in practice, they're perfectly happy to condone a blind dictator.
Condone, or, you know, in some cases, they themselves are, you know,
enacting
such violence. You've spoken of the role of the political artist, you know, and the importance of documenting injustices and inequalities now more so than ever. Can you elaborate on that point for me?
Well, in my country, In the past, students, cultural activists, have played a very, very important role. They played a role prior to liberation. They played a role during liberation and even immediately after liberation. But sadly today, the very people whom you would have relied upon to speak up at such a critical moment have chosen to stay silent. And part of it is fear, but I think part of it also is people wanting to be closer to the power structures, wanting to pick up the crumbs, looking for the grant that they will get and maybe a few awards and things like that. And basically they've sold out and we need them now much more than we ever did.
And do you see that situation getting any better in that sense?
It is and it isn't. Certainly at a certain level, I think the people who've done well are the very people who have continued to skim off. But there are very, very good people on the ground taking extremely dangerous risks to continue the good fight. Mm-hmm. And even within media, there are one or two media houses that continue to speak out despite all of this. I'm amazed that they've been able to hang on in there. But, well, hats off to them.
And, you know, on a broader political level, you know, what are some of the things that concern you the most?
I think this lack of freedom of expression is something that is overarching because you've got a situation where one's voice has been taken away. I mean, I was in jail and certainly my freedoms were not there in a material sense. But now that I'm outside, if I need to accept that I do not have a voice, I'm still in jail as far as I'm concerned. If my freedom of thought, if my freedom of expression isn't there, if I cannot feel safe in my own home, that's not much of a release. So that is there. But for me, the biggest concern really is, I mentioned the institutions being damaged earlier, mm-hmm. and that certainly a nation takes a lot of time to recover from. But I think the biggest damage has happened in the education sector. The fact that really the education system has been destroyed is something that will take us decades to recover from. And teachers now have become part of that political game. And when that happens, who do you have left to look up to?
Everything you're saying sounds so familiar. You know, situations that I think we are facing here in Malaysia. But, I mean, you know, even we managed to overthrow a very corrupt previous government. So I guess to never give up on that hope, that is something that is very, very important.
Well, completely. And I think if you look at it the other way around, it is when you say, what's the use? When you say there's no point, that is when they've won.
That's
because
accurate.
Then they no longer need to do anything. You've done the work for them. And I think that is really where our resistance has to be. We need to continue to believe, we need to continue to hope, and we need to continue to fight.
And, you know, you mentioned briefly that you have an exhibition dedicated to your photojournalism. You know, that's being featured in the Rubin Museum of Art in New York, you know, and it's a retrospective of your work, am I correct? But, you know, how has that sort of international recognition of your work, do you think that has helped in this fight for justice in Bangladesh?
It certainly helped in terms of getting the information out because the government has done a very good job of cloaking what there
very
is in
job.
Terms of a democratic garb. And I think that exposure has, in a sense, revealed the inner workings. That's true. But I think also it gives hope to people. When you think that despite all of this, despite having been in jail, despite all the repression that we're under and the government continuing to harass us the way they are, the fact that you can get your work out, that you can be reaching to a much broader public and that your story can be told, it's something that must give hope.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, for people who do encounter your work, for example, you know, the idea that if they speak up, you know, they think that perhaps that's not going to have any effect whatsoever. You know, what would your message be to them?
I think you have to be speaking out regardless at any point, because I'll turn that thing around. At the end of the day, you know, we live and we grow up. If all that we get in life are the material returns of a career, a mortgage, a house and a family and kids, that's not a particularly meaningful life.
No,
I think our footprint has to have greater meaning than that. And if through our lives we've not been able to bring about a change for the better in this planet that we live in, we haven't really lived.
And The Tide Will Turn, that is your newest book, and it documents your experiences, you know, and also the global support for your release that we were talking about earlier, and also the ongoing fight for democracy in Bangladesh. Tell me a little bit about the book.
The book came up, interestingly, because, I mean, Steidl is easily, I mean, it's the Rolls Royce of photo book publishing. It's what is the Holy Grail, and everyone looks up to it. And I'm, having known Steidl, having spent time with them, I'm aware about how meticulous and how much care they take into their publications. So when Gerhard Steidl came over to Bangladesh in March and said to me, I want to do your book, I was ecstatic. I was very happy, very honored. But I knew how long they take. But I took a chance. I sort of said, you know, I have a show coming up in November. I'd like the book for then. And Gerhard smiled and said, you give me the manuscript in August, I'll give you the book in November. I gave him the manuscript on the 27th of August. 7th of November, 10:30 a.m., the finished book in beautiful form arrived at the gallery in Rubin in New York.
Amazing. That is amazing. And I mean, tell me about what it is. You know, it's, I know there's also a chapter each on arts and politics. There's even the exchange of letters between yourself and Arundhati Roy.
Yeah. So I was very lucky and thankful that I had Vijay Prashad, someone I have a huge respect for, who agreed to edit the book. And I must give him a lot of credit. It was a lot of jumbled material that he massaged into the form of a book. And mm-hmm. he also helped guide me later on. So there are four chapters, effectively. The first looks at my period in jail. And an interesting part of that is the fact that here's a photographer, a visual person, telling a story when the camera itself is missing. So looking at how that story may be told, I think, is an interesting challenge. And then there are two chapters about art and politics and their interplay. And for me, certainly, they are very much intertwined. And that is what I talk about, how one plays with the other. But there is also the historical element, looking at the evolution of photography within Bangladesh, some of the greats who've contributed in the past. So it's an important historical chapter that is told. And then the last chapter is based on a letter that Arundhati wrote to me on my 100th day in prison.
Just before your release then?
Before my release. So she did it for Penn International. The letter was smuggled to me and I was able to read it, but I couldn't respond. But when I came out, I did respond. But what I also did was I stole her title. The Tide Will Turn is a phrase from her expression. Of course, I took her permission, but I felt it was very pertinent because I do believe the tide will turn and it is up to us to ensure that it does.
And, you know, you just had the launch in Malaysia here. Where can we get our hands on the book, you know, for anyone who's interested?
It's available on the Steidl book, on the Steidl website, on Amazon itself. Here, I believe, I should remember the name, but I don't, there is a publisher. But I think Jaffer has contacts with them and Publica might well still have copies left. But we have them in Bangladesh. And despite all of this, we continue to send them out.
That's very promising. That's very hopeful to hear. And, you know, you are a very busy person. You know, you're heading off to Australia. There's a lot of travel for you. What are you working on next?
Two things. One, 2021 is the 50th anniversary of Bangladesh.
That's right.
And we're now putting together a major show looking at Bangladesh through its own photographers. Mm-hmm. But it will have not only photography, but photography, writing, and, you know, analysis of the situation. So we will premiere it in Dhaka in our gallery, but then it goes to the Royal Ontario Museum in Toronto.
Yeah.
That's one. The other is something I've taken up because of the practicalities of my present existence. I used to go around on a bicycle. I've been cycling for 50 years. As much as a political statement as anything else. But today it's no longer safe for me to do so. I'm far too vulnerable that way. I don't carry a mobile phone with me. There are other safety precautions I need to take. That also means I cannot work the way I used to. stopping in the streets, talking to strangers, etc. So I'm now doing a series of portraits of survivors of torture over the years, telling their stories, and also photographically trying to record the emotions as they go through that period in their memory.
That's amazing. And is that going to be a compilation as well? Or?
At the moment, I'm just building it up because obviously it's also a question of them being safe in doing so, them being comfortable in doing so, and how we present that work in the future is something that everyone in the team needs to be comfortable with. So it is a body of work, but I've since been approached by many people too, who suggested that I make it an international project because, as you rightly pointed out yourself, Bangladesh is not the only country that's going through this.
And I do know that, I mean, climate change, of course, is a very pressing issue in Bangladesh. And I believe that's something also that you feel quite strongly about.
We've been doing it, recording it a lot, not I myself necessarily, but the entire team. And I am actually giving a talk in Paris at UNESCO. I'm giving a keynote in Paris on the 9th on that issue. But it is something, again, we've been working on for a long time. I think we live in a connected world. And I think that is one of the things I want to remind people of, that your well-being affects mine and my well-being affects yours. And something like climate change does not recognize these international borders.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for joining me today. Is there any last message that you'd like to leave us with?
I think all of us, wherever we are, we need to ask very hard questions of our own governments. While Bangladesh is in the situation in which it is, it can get away with it because others are complicit. And I think in each one of our countries, we need to ask very tough questions of our own leaders to ensure that they do not, in some ways, contribute to the situation we're in.
Thank you so much for joining me today.
Good to be here.
I've been speaking to Shahidul Alam. He's a photojournalist, he's an activist, an essayist, and an educator. And we were talking about a lot of things, the role of the political artist, the importance of documenting injustices and inequalities, and also about his latest book called The Tide Will Turn. And I think we can get our hands on that quite easily if we go search online. Do you have any social media channels that you...
Oh, yes. I mean, they were all stolen from me when I got arrested. I mean, the government still has my laptop and my mobile phones, and for a while had all my passwords. So all my social media had gone. I've managed to get all of them back. Twitter was a lot more problematic than the others, but I've now got them back. At Shahidul is my Twitter handle.
At Shahidul. All right. So if we want to follow you for updates, at Shahidul on Twitter is the best.
One of them.
One of them. All right. So Facebook and Instagram.
Instagram, Facebook, Flickr. I'm there everywhere. I'm an activist. I'm a fighter. I use every tool that works.
Thank you so much. So I've been speaking to Shahidul Alam, photojournalist, activist, essayist, and educator. Again, you can follow him on all the social media channels, the usual ones that we're used to, and keep in touch with him that way, I suppose, as well, right? And also get your hands on the book, search for The Tide Will Turn, and you can find out more about how you can get your hands on that book. If you miss any part of this interview or any previous Live and Learn interviews, you can search for the podcast on our BFM app, available on Google Play, the App Store, and also on Spotify. This has been Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.